Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, May 21st. I'm Jordan Pangelinan, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Students for a Democratic Society march in opposition of Bill 1040. Eureka Council votes down controversial camping ordinance. And Mendocino County Auditor Controller faces transition hurdles following return to office. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. Students for a Democratic Society gathered at 4 p.m. on May 20th from the Holverson Park Amphitheater and marched to Eureka City Hall, their numbers growing as they made it to the doors. Some activists set up vigils in anticipation of the 6 o'clock meeting, while others laid out sleeping bags on the sidewalk amid growing concerns over the proposed ordinances that would increase penalties for unlawful camping, sitting, and lying in public spaces, from an infraction to a misdemeanor. Here is Ruhula Agasales' thoughts on the Bill 1040.
Criminalization of poverty, first, is not working. Second, is not ethical. They are citing the Supreme Court ruling, also reminding them that the same Supreme Court has ruled against bodily autonomy and abortion rights. So what's next? Are they going to ban expression of exhaustion in the sidewalk? I'm going to make some parallels between this and the federal government, that is, for instance, the White House is trying to define gender. So now the city, is not surprising that the city wants to tell us where to sit, where to rest, where to lie. I think this is absurd, only because it's legal to penalize and to criminalize something, it doesn't mean it's ethical to do so.
While the city suggests these measures aim to encourage individuals to seek social services, many community members argue that such measures could further criminalize homelessness and make worse of the challenges faced by the unhoused community. Margie Wolf, a grad student at Cal Poly Humboldt, mentioned.
I think it should be taken off the table because, like I said, it just adds another loophole for them to jump through instead of making it streamlined. And like I said, there are already programs in place. What really needs to happen is more partnership between Arcata and Eureka, because for the houseless community, they don't see it as a different municipality. They're fluid and they move, and so the services need to move too.
The community members are hoping to help aim the shift of the conversation to a more humane and effective solution and increase access to shelter and supportive resources. Here's what community member Patricia Kansley had to say.
Apparently, businesses and people mm-hmm. see these homeless people sleeping in hallways, and they are dirty. Mm-hmm. I worked with AHA. They only get a shower maybe once every couple of weeks. And this... You can't be clean that way. So of course there's going to be a lot of people that are upset, but you can't take it out on the homeless because of the fact that criminalizing the homeless is not going to solve the issue. They don't have any money. It's total silliness. It needs to be first housing and that's it. You need to house these people and then start programs, because homelessness can cause mental instability. I've seen it. I've taken care of people in the hospital like that. And mental instability, also, you want to break away from life. So, of course, you do drugs. That is what happens. People take the little money they have and they use it to break away from reality.
In a narrow vote, Eureka's controversial anti-camping ordinance failed to gain city council approval. Daniel Mintz reports.
A majority of the Eureka City Council has voted to reject a controversial ordinance making homelessness-related activities like camping misdemeanor crimes. Another lengthy public hearing was held May 20th on the proposed law, this one ending in a 3-2 vote against approval. A significant factor in the majority decision is what was described as the broadness of the law. It would have made sitting, lying, and camping illegal on public and private property, with conditional exemptions for residential properties and other circumstances. City officials have said the law's intent isn't to punish people, but rather to provide leverage in addressing dangerous situations and in guiding people to services who would otherwise not seek them. Attending the meeting remotely, City Manager Miles Slattery gave case examples of situations where the ordinance would help. One involves an aggressive homeless man accused of multiple serious assaults. Public safety issues and how to address them were discussed in this exchange between Councilmember Mario Fernandez and Slattery, at one point stirring responses from the large audience there to oppose the ordinance.
How are our public spaces currently unsafe in the absence of this ordinance?
I think that the letter that I wrote, the memo talking about John Doe, clearly demonstrates the amount of assaults that are going on down there is unsafe.
So is John Doe not arrested then?
Because there wasn't people, as I stated in the memo, that were willing to file charges. So therefore, when these things happen and somebody's hit with a metal bar and somebody's arm gets broken, that person's arm that got broken wasn't willing to press charges. That's what happened. And yes, that does happen. And as far as other instances that are unsafe, I think I get a lot of commentary from our volunteer trail stewards, whether it's a perception or reality, that they don't feel safe, whether it's dogs, whether it's just uncleanliness, that they don't feel safe.
Jacob Rosen, the city's managing mental health clinician, said the ordinance's provision on allowing diversion to services allows the city to bypass the conventional judicial system and, quote, create another referral path. That would be done through the city's law enforcement-assisted diversion program. But almost all of those who spoke during a 3.5-hour public comment period were strongly against the ordinance. Much of the commentary was visceral, with speakers describing the ordinance as nefarious, inhumane, and an act of violence against our dignity and humanity. One speaker said if the council approves the law, quote, you will have a stain where your heart should be. And at one point, the council was accused of genocide. Councilmember Leslie Castellano said the degree of distrust points to the need for a different process leading to new approaches.
I believe in our capacity to work alongside one another to co-create a community that recognizes our interdependence. My well-being is deeply connected to the well-being of people who are sleeping on our streets. I want to acknowledge the work of staff in bringing this item before us for our consideration. I recognize an intent to do something to change people's lives, but I think that this strategy will erode the trust that is needed to build long-lasting change while only having limited successes. Currently, our social safety net is under attack by the federal administration, and it really is up to us to enact strategies at the local level that resonate with how we envision our humanity. The commons have become sites where the expression of systemic failures place strain on local resources and place neighbors at odds with one another. I would like for us to hold a series of community conversations designed as learning spaces where we can generate ideas, questions, pilot programs, and hope.
With audience response prompting an admonition from Mayor Kim Burgell, Councilmember Scott Bauer commented on an overriding issue related to opposition to the ordinance, distrust of police and city government.
What I think I hear from you all is a lack of trust, right? I mean, that's the bottom line, lack of trust in authority, lack of trust in laws. But do we want to abolish all laws because they could be subject to abuse? That's a simple question I'm asking, and you obviously disagree with it.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So, and we don't banter back and forth, whether it's midnight or whether it's 9. You guys all had your 3 minutes, and I would appreciate you giving him his. Thank you.
Anyways,
oh, 2.5 this meeting. Yeah, thank you.
Anyways, I appreciate staff for what you all do, and I would say that maybe as Councilmember Moulton said, this ordinance isn't perfect, but it was something, it was an attempt that we could have modified, and I still think we should do something. And I hope that we can all learn to trust each other in the future and trust our government
Castellano's motion to reject the ordinance was approved, with Bauer and Councilmember Katie Moulton dissenting. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
On Wednesday, May 14th, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., Taxpayers Against Genocide and the National Lawyers Guild International Committee held a press conference announcing a legal complaint filed with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. The complaint accuses the U.S. government of complicity in genocide in Gaza, backed by sworn affidavits from Palestinian-American plaintiffs who lost loved ones in the conflict. Organizers and endorsing civil rights groups marched to the White House after filing and planned to meet with members of Congress the following day.
A class action lawsuit targeting U.S. arms sales to Israel initially filed in Northern California against Congressman Jared Huffman and Mike Thompson has taken an unprecedented turn. After a San Francisco court dismissed that class action lawsuit, Taxpayers Against Genocide has now brought their case to the international stage with the help of allied groups who also oppose Israel's military actions overseas.
I only want to tell you guys that we officially submitted the... Thank you very much. We will be following up with the commission with more evidence. As we get it, we have more affidavits that are also coming. So we will be trying to move it as fast as we can. Thank you all for being here, for being a part of this, for allowing me to represent you in this effort.
See you later.
In an historic move, the grassroots group has filed a new legal complaint with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, backed by the National Lawyers Guild, the Center for American-Islamic Relations, CARE, Doctors Against Genocide, Black Alliance for Peace, and Code Pink, just to name a few. We were in Washington, D.C. to report as the unprecedented legal challenge was filed. With Humboldt and Mendocino activists directly involved in the action, we're excited to bring you a report directly from D.C. as the multi-organization effort challenges U.S. policy on military spending as it relates to tax dollars and documented war crimes committed by the State of Israel and supported by the U.S. government, raising critical questions about compliance with international and United States law.
Tune in tomorrow for a special 30-minute newscast sharing the details from Ryan Hudson's news coverage in D.C. That's tomorrow at 6 p.m. Turning to Mendocino County, Auditor Controller faces transition hurdles following return to office. KZYX's Elise Cox reports.
Mendocino County's Auditor Controller and Treasurer Tax Collector Shamis Cubison is facing significant challenges after returning to work following her exoneration of criminal charges brought against her by the county's district attorney. These challenges are detailed in a letter sent to the Board of Supervisors on May 19th. The letter follows a request for help Cubison made at the last meeting of the Board of Supervisors on May 6th. At that meeting, Cubison asked the board to direct Assistant CEO Sarah Pierce to assist her in preparing year-end reports. Pierce filled in for Cubison during her absence.
The county's outside audit firm, Clifton Larson Allen, has asked me if we will have the year-end books closed with all year-end balance sheet entries completed and be ready to start the outside audit by early September, with the intention to issue financial statements by the end of December. Given that I was shut out of my office for 17 months and have only been back in the office for 2 months, the only way that we will meet those dates is if Sarah Pierce is made available to me directly when I need her to provide information, not through anyone else, from now until July 15th. She will then need to be assigned to work with me and my staff from July 15th through the issuance of the ACFR. There have been many changes to the financial systems, and there are gaps in the information left behind for me and my other staff to follow. And there is not enough time for me to review all of the current year's transactions and research and interpret the many changes made while I was out without her assistance. And if I'm unable to have the assurance that she will be assigned to work directly with me and my staff, I will not be able to commit to the audit firm that we will be ready by September. If we cannot commit to their schedule, it is unlikely that we will be able to close and issue reports on time, as they will reassign Mendocino, our audit, to a different time frame much later in their schedule. In addition, Sarah Pierce will need to be authorized and willing to sign the management representation letter and the ACFR with me. And I will need to know if the board is willing to give that direction to staff in order to provide the support necessary to meet the goals of closing the year, completing the audit, and issuing the reports timely.
In a letter dated May 13th, Haschek said that the Board of Supervisors did not believe Cubison's request was reasonable. Cubison's attorney, Therese Cannata, responded May 19th with a detailed description of the hurdles Cubison faced in dealing with the office of Chief Executive Darcy Antle. The letter describes a transition memo prepared by Assistant CEO Sarah Pierce as hastily written and wholly inadequate. The letter notes that when Cubison requested follow-up meetings, Antle told her she would need to submit questions to Pierce in writing. While Cubison tried to follow that process, she described a number of challenging roadblocks. She said processes developed and implemented by Pierce, including changes to the county's accounting structure, financial statements, and transaction processes, were not documented and are not known to the staff of the Auditor Controller's office. In addition, the filing system used by Pierce, which included storing drafts in her personal OneDrive, is not familiar to staff. After receiving the letter from Cannata, Haschek summoned Cubison to appear before the Board of Supervisors on Tuesday.
I was not aware we were going to have an in-depth discussion this morning. I appreciate the work that Ms. Pierce has done. I truly do. We have a good working relationship in the past, and I hope we will have a good working relationship in the future. I appreciate the work that she did. I appreciate what she has implemented. However, there is not a lot of information left back for me to understand exactly what was done and how it was done and why it was done. I'm not saying that it is incorrect or wrong. There is situations where I need to understand why. There are items that I had discussed with the previous audit team, and we had discussed implementation plans, and they were not implemented in that way. They were implemented differently, but I'm not saying that they are incorrect, but they are not what we had previously discussed. There are other situations that I have encountered that are challenging to navigate because I'm having a difficult time locating all of the relevant documents.
Pierce defended her tenure as acting auditor, controller, treasurer, tax collector. She clarified that while she did save drafts on her personal drive at work, she did not save documents on her home computer.
I do have my OneDrive, which I was saving draft documents on, and I was trying to be very cautious about saving finalized documents on the shared drive.
Meanwhile, public opinion was scathing.
My name is Teresa McNerlin. I'm a resident, a U.S. Army veteran, a mom, and a wife. This goes back to the irrational decision that this board made, led by this Darcy Antle, the CEO, and the DA, to take that woman and press felony charges against her, to remove her from her office, to put somebody who already had a job in her place for 17 months, to withhold all her pay and benefits. And then when it goes to court and you find out that you've made a mistake, this is what you do? You can't acknowledge you made a mistake and try to move on, try to make that woman whole, try to give her her back pay, try to have some cooperation?
After hearing from Cubison, Pierce, and McNerland, the supervisors decided not to formally accept Haschek's letter. For KZYX News, I'm Elise Cox.
In state news, Barbara Lee is sworn in as Oakland's mayor. KPFA's Kennedy Cuello reports.
Former U.S. Congresswoman Barbara Lee is now officially mayor of Oakland. During her ceremony, she took the oath of office upon a Bible she said belonged to her grandfather, who was born just 2 years after Juneteenth in Galveston, Texas. She brought her mother with her and described her life growing up in various cities, including Oakland. She says her goal is to make Oakland a better place for all and make the city more appealing.
Create opportunities for our young people. Ensure a safe path for our sons and daughters to have long, productive lives and to be housed or own homes in a safe, clean city. To address the moral disgrace of our unsheltered population with dignity. To support our senior citizens and our artists. And yes, to recommend solutions to make our city and its people economically healthy and vibrant.
Lee says that residents are clearly tired of the status quo and demand a new leader. But she says this is not something that can be done alone. One of her promises was to bring more transparency to city decisions. She invited input from residents to come up with action plans for what to do, both short and long term. Lee also emphasized that she plans to keep the public informed in any way possible, such as community forums, online, and listening sessions.
Oaklanders expect and demand that we must govern in a new way. And y'all know me, right? Where there's a will, there's a way. And it starts with the people. There's a saying that people closest to the challenges are the ones closest to the solutions. Over the next 100 days, we will bring Oaklanders from all walks of life to help inform how our government can better serve the people and usher in a new era of prosperity and progress.
A big issue for her first 100 days will be the city budget. The city is facing a $270 million deficit, and she said that it will not be an easy task, but it will be tackled. She laid out plans to make sure tax dollars are spent efficiently and said she plans to use her access to the best financial advisors to go over the current budget proposal and modify it. She says it's important again for the city to come together during this time.
My job is to lead our city out of a budget crisis and a period of financial stability. Not gonna be easy, but we're gonna do everything we can do, everything. And we can only do this together if we have a strong and vibrant downtown, thriving small businesses in every single Oakland neighborhood, and those that preserve the character of our great city and contribute to our vitality, and a city that welcomes investment, and also a city that values our artists.
Lee's first 100 days begins now and ends August 28th. For KPFA News, I'm Kennedy Cuello.
In national news, UK, European Union sanction Israel over Gaza, West Bank violence. Christina Anastad reports.
This war has gone on for far too long. We cannot allow the people of Gaza to starve.
In an address to Parliament, Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer called the level of suffering by children in Gaza utterly intolerable. And he slammed Israel's pace in allowing a trickle of food into Gaza, 5 truckloads for some 2 million Palestinians after a near 3-month blockade.
The level of suffering, innocent children being bombed again, is utterly intolerable. And I want to put on record today that we're horrified by the escalation from Israel. We repeat our demand for a ceasefire as the only way to free the hostages. We repeat our opposition to settlements in the West Bank. And we repeat our demand to massively scale up humanitarian assistance into Gaza. The recent announcement that Israel will allow a basic quantity of food into Gaza, a basic quantity, is totally and utterly inadequate.
After his speech, Foreign Secretary David Lammy announced sanctions against West Bank settlements and the suspension of trade talks with Israel. This as the United Nations warns 14,000 Palestinian babies can die in the next 48 hours as the hunger crisis worsens by the minute. Israel said it's allowed more aid trucks to enter Gaza, and the UN is anticipating some 100 trucks to provide desperate desperately needed relief. Tess Ingram, spokesperson for UNICEF, the UN's Children's Fund, Middle East and North Africa region, says the amount of trucks entering is a drop in the ocean of what's needed.
The entire Gaza Strip is at risk of famine, that there are a rising number of children with malnutrition. We're also seeing rising levels of disease. And because of the aid blockade, the supplies needed to treat malnutrition and treat disease haven't got in. And as a result of that, children are suffering and at risk of dying, including babies who are in incubators, infants who are malnourished. There really is a humanitarian crisis of a scale that we haven't seen before, and that's why getting this aid in is so critical.
The UN estimates some 600 trucks a day entered Gaza during a ceasefire earlier this year. Moral outrage at the situation is growing. The European Union is also reassessing its trade relations with Israel. Some say, though, nations could do more. Youssef Monayir is head of the Palestine-Israel Program and senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C.
The U.K. announced that it's going to suspend these trade talks, but it's still providing logistical assistance for the military there. It's still providing surveillance flights. It's still providing weapons. And so, you know, to offer statements while there are thousands of people on the brink of starvation, is really just insulting at this point. The question is whether or not it will build momentum for greater action. And there does seem to be growing anger now in Europe. We've seen statements from the Czechs today using language around genocide. The question is, does this translate beyond words to concrete actions that will actually register with the Israeli government as a message that they can't ignore?
Back in the UK, lawmakers are also calling for sanctions against Israel's finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, who at a press conference Monday said the only reason Israel was sending minimal amounts of food into Gaza was not to lose international support for its military campaign to drive Palestinians to the south, then to international countries, a plan decried as ethnic cleansing. Smotrich also said they needed the support of allies to protect Israel from The Hague. The International Criminal Court is headquartered in The Hague and has issued arrest warrants against Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for war crimes in Gaza. I'm Christina Onnested, reporting for Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Ryan Hudson, Elise Cox, Kennedy Cuello, Christopher Martinez, and Christina Anastad. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscast for online listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send us an email at news@kmud.org. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Jordan Pangelinan.